Are we good to go?
Yep.
All right.
Whenever you are.
All right.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Norris.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Listen to the Prophets, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. And with that simple premise, you should have a pretty good idea of what we're going to be doing today. But just to make sure, I will specifically say what we're going to do. Today we're going to talk about the second season episode of Deep Space Nine, a little one called Profit and Loss, which features the return of one of our favorite supporting characters on the show, plain simple Garak. And if that is enough to get you excited, well then maybe the inclusion of guest star Mary Crosby might light your fire. I'm certain it'll thrill my Just 1% of the Guys co-host, J. David Weider, who was quite enamored with her character on Dallas. But this isn't my Dallas Dynasty podcast, this is our Deep Space Nine podcast, and the R includes myself, Sean Engel, and the JR and Bobby Ewing to my Jock Ewing, Mr. Paul Spataro, and Mr. Andrew Leyland. Hello, gentlemen.
So that means Andy's in the shower right now.
No, I'm the man from Atlantis, dude.
Oh, that would have been such a great crossover, a Dallas Man from Atlantis crossover. You could have Bobby swimming underneath. You could have Bobby go out to the, to the Gulf of Mexico and check out the oil wells out there and swim out there and tell them to stop polluting the Gulf Coast. Yeah, it'd work. Why not?
I thought you were going to say when he stepped out of the shower, he would have been the man from Atlantis.
Oh, that would have even been better. See, this is why I'm not good at writing, screenplays or anything.
Fan fiction.
Yes.
The man from Dallas.
Poor Bobby.
What was he that for one season? I was not a Dallas viewer.
I can tell you, aside from the show that I did with J. David Weider, where we did that sort of April Fool's episode, I have seen exactly one episode of Dallas all the way through, and I saw the reveal of who shot JR. And that was about, the one where everyone's like, we're going to find out who shot JR this episode, and they showed it was all, a dream or whatever.
And I suspect if you were not a Dallas viewer, the who shot JR would have been probably underwhelming anyway.
Well, and when I watched it, I know I was over at my grandparents' house, and they were big fans of the show, and they were watching it, and I was probably, I had to be in, I wasn't even in my teens. I think this came out in, well, maybe I was in my teens. This came out in like the early 80s. So I was completely uninterested in it. I was like, these guys in cowboy hats talking about oil and shooting each other. I didn't really care. Where was Buck Rogers? Where was Battlestar Galactica?
Where was Wilma Deering?
I did watch Dynasty, though.
Well, that had Charlton Heston on it.
No, it just that was the Dynasty spin-off, the Colbys.
Oh, the Colbys.
But Dynasty had Heather Locklear on it, and that was good enough to get me.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Thanks to me now, I don't think there was an episode of Dallas that I did not see.
You were a lucky...
And that should give you much pride.
Or so, bro.
And I can't believe nobody got an ABBA reference.
You may have to do the Dallas episode show with somebody else then, because Sean and I seem to be ill-prepared to handle it.
See, we've got Firefly, Magnum, Babylon 5, Buffy, Angel, Dallas, Dynasty, Colby.
Burn Notice.
Burn Notice. Oh, good lord, it just keeps building up. thankfully, you know, my retirement will pay for my internet fees, and, you know, we'll be able to keep this going for as long as possible. So, great.
I'm looking forward to Hazard County by any other name, a Gilmore Girls podcast. I'm really looking forward to us doing that one.
Oh, God, shoot me.
So you're not down with us doing the Gilmore Girls retrospective?
Well, that falls on the long list of shows I've never bothered to watch and take pride in not having seen.
Well, then we're in the same boat. Sorry, Andy.
I'm very upset that my love of Lorelai Gilmore will go unheard.
Now, who played Lorelai Gilmore?
Lauren Graham.
Okay, yeah, she was always cute. I remember when she was on Seinfeld, she played one of Jerry's girlfriends.
Did she
Wait, can we do the Continuum podcast? Let's not forget that one.
Which one?
The Continuum podcast. Does only me watch Continuum?
Is that a Stargate ripoff?
It's a spin-off. Sci-fi thing from Canada. It's really good. It's on Sci-Fi. It's on Netflix. Watch it. It's only 4 seasons. There are only 13 episodes.
See, I gave up on sci-fi when their regular spate of shows, you know, turned into wrestling and Sharknado sequels.
It's not a sci-fi show. In America, sci-fi just show it. It's a Canadian science fiction show that is actually really quite good.
I'm too busy watching Sharknado 3 this week to...
Well, I understand why the quality that is Sharknado 3 would rise to the top. But when you've finished watching that pinnacle of Western cinematic achievement, give Continuum a go.
I'm sensing sarcasm.
I don't see how you can say anything that has Ian Ziering and Tara Reid and David Hasselhoff in is not the most magnificent thing that has ever been created.
Now, I was skimming the internet because it was all over, like, the Yahoo homepage, which, you know, which was my homepage up at work. Is Ann Coulter really playing the vice president in this movie?
You know what? I didn't realize that was her, but yes.
Oh, and I don't know who that is. So.
And Mark Cuban is playing the president.
Oh, for the love of God. Mark Cuban is like he's the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, am I thinking right?
That's correct.
Which is a major league NBA basketball team in the States. And Ann Coulter is a sort of very right-wing conservative commentator who likes to, you know, she's a very skinny blonde hair. She always likes to rile people up on the left. She's done a lot of books and she's very right-wing, obviously. So I saw some sort of, you know, the 10 best gifts from Sharknado and some of the goofy crap that was going on in that, and I was just like, Ann Coulter is the vice president and she's skiing down a stairwell on like the on like a painting of George Washington or something. I was like, this film just... See, I don't mind films that have high aspirations that are bad, that just fail to meet those aspirations. I don't like intentionally bad films that try to be bad and get people to enjoy them because they are bad.
I mean, it's not worth a second viewing or anything, but I did laugh at certain points. Lou Ferrigno playing a presidential bodyguard and telling them not to make him angry. Moments like that I find amusing. Was that a sneeze or a laugh? Because it was
a sneeze, sorry.
All right, either one, God bless you.
Thank you.
See, you know, all the little cameos on there, it detracts from the fact that it just emphasizes the fact that it's trying as hard as possible be bad.
Oh, it clearly is. There's no question. And it is. It's succeeding in being bad.
See,
it does not rise above the intellectual level of a very, very bad sitcom.
See, I would rather it actually attempt to be somewhat good in its bizarre nature and fail rather than intentionally try to fail. That just makes it feel very weak. I would rather have a a failed movie the next successful failure, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying, and each one of these has succeeded to a lesser extent than the prior one, as far as its campy nature. You know, the first one came in a little unheralded, and I did find that amusing. And now it's gotten sillier each time and dopier each time, and intentionally so, and I could see where that might be off-putting. But just the same, I watched it with my kids, and we did laugh.
See, you know, since they're doing things, you know, that are sort of B-movies that are sort of goofy, I'm more interested in the Ash versus the Evil Dead thing that's supposed to be coming out. And I know this is not related to Deep Space Nine or all, but since we brought up Sharknado, you know, Bruce Campbell was showed up in a lot of sci-fi action films on the Sci-Fi Channel, and I'm glad to see that Bruce Campbell's going to be coming back and reprising his role. And if I don't know, did you see did either of you guys see the trailer for that? The sort of 3-minute thing that they put out?
I've not, no, but I am looking forward to it because they've got everyone, right? Sam Raimi's back and Lucy Lawless is going to be in it because Sam Raimi's back. So it looks quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. If you get a chance, go check out the trailer for it. It's very self-referential. Bruce Campbell, it starts out with a scene that looks like Bruce Campbell strapping on the harness for the chainsaw. And no, what he's doing is he's strapping on a girdle because he's gained so much weight that he looks like, you know, he's eaten himself. So it's very humorous. He makes the, you know, makes a lot of comments that he needs to do more cardio because he's getting winded just, you know, standing around. So it looks like it's going to be a lot of fun, and it looks like it's going to be bloody as well. So that's good.
He actually looks thinner in this than he did in Burn Notice.
Well, yeah, I think he kind of let himself go. But, you know, that was, wasn't that sort of his character trait?
He was in Burn Notice, he was supposed to be a gone to seed ex-SEAL. So the fact that he'd put a bit of weight on actually worked for the show. Mm. And I got the feeling that he did that deliberately, because as the series goes on, he does lose a bit, like he felt he'd gone too far, and they actually reference it in the dialogue. So it does look like he's got trimmer for Ash versus the Evil Dead.
Yeah, and what you were seeing in the trailer is sort of him starting out, and then later on when he knows that he has to fight off the Evil Dead, he's going to sort of trim down and, you know, get back to fighting stature. So, but yeah, we're completely not talking about Deep Space Nine, are we? Do we want to go talk about an episode?
Yeah, I think we're just surprised Bruce Campbell never did a Star Trek. I think that's where we went with it.
Yeah, I think that would have been interesting. Yeah, Star Trek versus the Evil Dead. Before we get into the show, did we want to read something from the Bible, the DS9 Bible, before we get to that?
I guess we could do that.
Cool.
Hang on for a second. There we go. The next section in the DS9 Bible, is runabouts. Starfleet has stationed 3 mid-sized runabout-class patrol ships at DS9, which allow our characters to travel to the numerous star systems in the sector, as well as through the wormhole. These ships are 20 meters long, with impulse and warp capabilities, a maximum speed of warp 4.7. They're generally operated by a 2-man crew, but a single pilot can control them if necessary. They can transport up to 40 people, but that's a crowd. They are cramped, uncomfortable sleeping quarters for six... There are cramped, uncomfortable sleeping quarters for 6 people. A multi-purpose room for meetings and dining is located directly off the cockpit. These ships are the symbol of the Federation's presence in this sector, the only Starfleet hardware in this eclectic environment. That's it about runabouts. Now, I think they were true to that in how they portrayed them, but I think they eventually came to the realization that they did handcuff themselves a little bit on a Star Trek Deep Space show to have so little ability to move around the universe. And that's why you eventually had to expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I think I like the description of them. One of the things, especially at the beginning of this season, we saw them using those 3 runabouts to essentially evacuate the majority of the station. And if we go with the Bible, they kind of said that the station usually holds anywhere from you know, around 100 to 150 people, you know, crew and, you know, basically citizens there as well. So saying that they can transport about 40 people and they only had 3 runabouts, that makes sense that they, you know, that works out in the show that they'd be capable of getting all these people off the station with just these 3 runabouts. So I'm liking the fact that they're keeping that continuity from the Bible to the show intact.
Yeah, can the runabouts fit 40? The ones that we see on the... I suppose if they're all stood up like they're in a subway.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm thinking. Yeah, because you look in the main cockpit of the runabout, and there's usually only like 4 seats. And then you've got the little back section where is the transporter or whatever shielded area. So...
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, the runabouts. Yeah, it does improve a bit when they bring in the Defiant, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, that they finally have a actual Starfleet ship that, you know, has a crew complement and, you know, much more offensive capability and defensive capability. You know, but that was all predicated on the fact that they had encountered the Dominion and needed a ship that could possibly fend off an attack from this organization. So, but yeah, the starting out having the runabouts there allowed them to get off the station, because yeah, there's only so much you can do just staying on the station. You need to get to other places, so the runabouts were a good idea to allow that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I like the initial thought of trying to keep them kind of tied to the station, but have them have, you know, limited ability to move about. But again, I can't argue with the way it worked out once they did come in with the Defiant and how that expanded their abilities and gave them a little bit more ability to expand some of the plot lines. Cricket.
I'm getting a lot of use out of that one. So, do we want to go ahead and move into the synopsis for the show?
Yeah, let's talk about profit and loss.
Alrighty then.
Oh, we'll always have Cardassia, because it's a blatant Casablanca ripoff.
I didn't even see that at all. I can't see how you're making that correlation. This feels nothing like Casablanca at all.
So we've already titled our episode...
Well, actually, I've gone for his looking at you, Quark, but I can change it if you want.
No, I think
I like that.
Brilliant.
Or play it again, Morn.
Did it for her, you can do it for me. Now play it.
Quark rekindles a passionate affair.
I love you, Quark.
But now she's a fugitive on the run.
I'm part of the Cardassian Underground.
And as the enemy prepares to attack...
The powering up the forward disruptors.
Shields. Lock on phasers and photon torpedoes.
He'll risk everything for her.
Following me will only get you killed.
I'll take that chance.
You see to it that they don't leave this station alive.
On the next episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine...
All right, Profit and Loss is the 18th episode of Season 2 of Deep Space Nine and aired on or about March 20th of 1994 in the U.S. It was written by Flip Kolber. Flip? Really? Okay. And Cindy Barkus, no relation to Carol, and was directed by Robert Weimer. It featured the main cast, as well as stars Mary Crosby as Natima, Andrew Robinson as Garrick, Michael Riley Burke as Hoke, Heidi Swedberg as Raquelin, and Edward Wiley as Gul Turan. And once again, I'm taking my synopsis from the Star Trek Deep Space Nine Companion, written by Terry J. Erdman and Paula M. Block. When hails to a damaged Cardassian vessel go unanswered, Sisko has it brought to Deep Space Nine. On board are 3 Cardassians, Professor Natima Lang and her students, Raquelin and Hoke. Lang explains that the damage to their ship was caused when they were caught in a meteor swarm, and Sisko offers the trio assistance with the repairs and suggests that they head for the promenade. In Quark's bar, Bashir fishes for clues about Garrick's past, while Odo tries to find out if Quark has acquired a small but illegal cloaking device. Suddenly, Quark recognizes Natima on the promenade and tries to speak with her, but Natima says that she wants nothing to do with Ferengi. Nevertheless, Quark manages to get Natima and her students to come into the bar for a drink. Quark makes it clear that he would like to renew their formal relationship, but the reunion is short-lived. Natima spots Garrick, the only Cardassian resident of the station, and quickly takes her leave. After O'Brien points out that the damage to the Natima's ship was clearly caused by Cardassian weapons, Sisko confronts her. Natima admits O'Brien is right and explains that her students are leaders of an underground movement that opposes the Cardassian military government. Their views have made them fugitives, and they're desperate to get off the station as soon as possible, particularly since they know that Garrick has seen them. Their fears are well-founded. A short time later, a Cardassian starship approaches Deep Space Nine and powers up its weapons. At the same time, Garrick appears in Ops and tells Sisko that Natiba's students are actually terrorists whom the Cardassian government wants returned. But Sisko refuses to turn over political refugees. At Quark's bar, the Ferengi, who has indeed obtained a cloaking device, offers it to Raquelin and Hogue for their escape if they convince Natima to stay behind on Deep Space Nine with him. Natima wants the cloaking device, but rejects the conditions. She then threatens Quark with a phaser, and when he moves towards her, she inadvertently fires, dropping him in his tracks. Alarmed, Natima kneels next to the stunned Ferengi and admits that she really does love him. Unfortunately, just as Quark finally convinces her to remain with him, Odo arrives to arrest her. Sisko unhappily informs them that the Bajoran Provisional Government has agreed to a prisoner swap with the Cardassians, and he is forced to abide by that decision. The prisoner swap is a result of a suggestion to Cardassian Central Command by Garrick, who hopes to restore himself to the government's good graces. A short time later, however, he received a visit from a warrior named Gul T'ran, who says that he can arrange for Garrick's return to Cardassia if he assassinates the three fugitives before they leave the station. Meanwhile, Quark has convinced Odo to help get the Cardassians off the station safely. The Ferengi escorts the trio to a cargo bay, only to find Garrick blocking the only source of escape. Garrick prepares to execute all four of them, and Quark attempts to convince him otherwise. Sensing Garrick's hesitation, T'ran appears from out of the shadows and announces that he will perform the execution himself. As for Garrick, he is to remain as a tailor on DS9 for the rest of his life. Central Command never did intend to restore his reputation. As T'ran takes aims at the fugitive, Garrick fires at T'ran, killing him. The two students head for their escape vessel, and to Quark's surprise, Natima says that she must join them and continue assisting the underground movement. Resigned to the fact that he can't stop her, Quark allows for her to leave. He exits the cargo bay with Garrick, two men who have lost what they desired most in life. And this was the start of a beautiful friendship. So, yeah, there are a lot of parallels in this episode to Casablanca, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because I've always thought the characters of Odo and Quark are very much akin to Rick and Louie from Casablanca. I like this episode. I think it's elevated specifically by Garrick. I've got to wonder how they get away with all this phaser fire on the station without someone coming down on them. And there's a little problem with this, this Gull who suddenly comes up missing at the end of the episode that they really don't deal with. But overall, the inclusion of Mary Crosby to the episode, Quark showing his love for this woman, building the backstory with Quark, and that he actually was sort of this scoundrel with a heart of gold, it really worked for me, and I got a lot of enjoyment out of this episode.
Yeah, I would say ditto. I mean, I'm really echoing your thoughts here, but I thought the Casablanca ripoff was so well done that it didn't bother me that it was a ripoff. It never felt like it was a parody of Casablanca. It just felt like it was taking the concept and applying it to Deep Space Nine. Same way that they'll take classic stories like Romeo and Juliet and use them over and over again, and if they're really well done, it doesn't necessarily take away from the narrative of the story. Armin Shimerman, when I saw Profit and Loss, I thought, okay, we're going to see an episode, the Negus is coming, and we're going to have your typical Ferengi episode, which is not a bad thing. But I was very surprised, and I didn't remember watching this episode before, although I know I've seen every episode at some point. And I really enjoyed it. Unlike episodes that have been coming up recently, it didn't take any effort at all to watch this one. Some of the episodes that I've been watching lately, you know, in the last, say, I don't know, 6 weeks or so, I start watching them and then my attention gets diverted and I have to rewind them and start them over again. There was nothing like that in this episode. I thought this was just really well done. The acting was great. The story was fun. I would agree with you that the two plot holes are the fact that there's phaser fire going on all over the place and there's no alarms being set off, and secondly that a Cardassian gull is killed, and you know, oh well, you know, it's no big deal. The one thing that did strike me, and that I'm a little, just slightly disappointed in, and it really is slight, is as we're learning more about Cardassia and Cardassian culture, other than the fact that they seem to be a little bit more militaristic and a little bit more opportunistic, their culture isn't portrayed as different enough from ours to make me happy. They almost seem like just us with these little spoon things on their heads and scales. So, you know, that's the thing. I wish their culture was just a little bit more easily differentiated from our own, and I don't see a lot of that at this point. And maybe that's intentional. Maybe that's because they want to say, you know, you're fighting people who are similar to you, and, you know, we're only making them aliens because we're a science fiction show. But that's my one little bit of criticism of what's going on with the show. But other than that, this was a really solid episode, and I thoroughly enjoyed watching it.
Okay. No, I don't disagree with anything. I just thought they just did Casablanca. They didn't bring anything to it. I think I would have preferred it.
They brought Garrick to it.
Well, let me finish. They didn't bring any. They just did Casablanca. They didn't parody Casablanca. They didn't really make it a Deep Space Nine version of Casablanca. They just did Casablanca. However, it has Garrick in it, and that alone made this just joyful to watch. Every time he's in a scene, he's just utterly magnificent. I don't know what it is about Andy Robinson. I don't know why he never became a bigger star than he did, because he's just blinding in this episode. And the ending, he kills him. Do you really think he doesn't have a plan for explaining where he's gone, or that he doesn't know anything? He's Garrick. He knows exactly what he's doing 20 minutes before he does it, and he's got a way out of it. So I think he's got a perfectly logical explanation for where that gull went, even if it's as simple as, well, he was fine when he left my tailor's shop, which he was, so he wouldn't be lying. So I didn't have a problem with Garrick killing that guy at the end and then it not being mentioned again, because I'm sure he's got a way out of it. Quark's brilliant, Armin Shimerman's brilliant in it. One thing I do like about it, even though they are just doing Casablanca, he's still Quark. And there are moments where you think he's going to sell everybody out just to make some money. And then he pulls back and realizes what he's doing. So he's brilliant in it. And I do think it's an episode where the actors and the characters elevate the material to make it a really fun and enjoyable episode from what is essentially just a tired pastiche. Not even a pastiche, just a tired retread of Casablanca.
Yeah, well, I think this differs where the last time we saw with the Negus, where we had a Ferengi, well, we had a Ferengi-centric episode prior, you know, after that, but with the Negus, that was definitely a pastiche of The Godfather, and there were direct references to Godfather, and that felt more like it was trying to be a parody. I think this benefits from the fact that it is in some way adapting the idea of Casablanca for Deep Space Nine. It's not trying to be a parody. It's not trying to, you know, do the same lines. It's doing what Casablanca essentially did, you know, the people trying to hide out from this oppressive government and trying to escape, you know, the threat of that, and putting it in the Deep Space Nine, you know, over the Deep Space Nine mold. And I think it really works. And I agree with you. If this episode didn't have Garrick in it, I don't think I would have liked it as much. But yes, every moment that Garak is on the screen is a joy to behold. The conversation between him and Quark in the tailor shop is just lined with subtext. Everything that he says about, you know, him being a tailor, or you should get a new suit, or this suit, you know, it's fashionable today, but, you know, something happens to it and it can become unfashionable. There's such great subtext. And I guess, what's her name? You know, this Flip Kolber and Cindy Marcus did an excellent job at writing these lines for Garak. And of course, Andrew Robinson, you know, delivers them in such a subtle, sly manner that you can't be anything but just completely enthralled in it.
My favorite bit's when he's talking with Bashir at the beginning, where he actually outright tells Bashir what he is, an outcast spy, and yeah, Bashir just doesn't believe him.
It's you can't be both. I never said I was either.
Yep, absolutely brilliant, which is what he is. That's what ultimately we find out what he is. So even when he tells you the truth, you can't be sure he's telling you the truth. He's just masterful.
I think I can say, you know, Sean, you said you'd enjoy the episode less if we hadn't had Garak on it. I'm going to say there isn't one episode in this entire series that has Garak on it that I wouldn't enjoy less if he was taken off of it. I mean, that's just how great his character is. Every episode is better for having him in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. even if it's a just a one, even if he's not integral to the part, if there is something where it's Bashir and Garak, you know, just having a conversation, that part of it elevates the show. And the fact that he's an integral part of this, and we get the motivation that he is exiled to the station. This isn't something that he wants to do, that he so desires to get back in the good graces with the Central Command, which I think this is the first time that the ruling government of Cardassia has actually been classified. It's Cardassian Central Command. That he's so wanting to get back there that he's willing to sell out people. And in the end, you don't know whether or not he would have gone through with killing these people. Because, you know, by the end, this Gol Turan, he was going to kill them anyway. And he probably wouldn't have let Garak come back even if he had done this. So it's, there's so many layers to the Cardassian characters, and especially Garak throughout the show. It's what engages me so with this series.
Yeah, this one didn't feel quite as difficult, and maybe I'm wrong, but it didn't feel quite as difficult to see what Garak's motivations were at the end. I think he was going to totally sell them out until he came to the realization that it wasn't going to do him any good anyway. So then he decided to do what he wanted to do.
Yeah, which was kill Torren, who he didn't like. So it's not really that Garak's done them a favor. He's going to be stuck on Deep Space Nine anyway. Why not have somebody on Deep Space Nine in a position of semi-prominence, Quark, owe him a favor? That's a good position for Garak to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any point where Garak is particularly heroic in... You know, I think his motivations are always his own, as mysterious as they may be at times. But it's just such a, like you say, such a layered performance on everything. Every sentence he gives can be taken at least two ways. I love the fact that he has clearly developed a liking of Bashir. He's fond of him, and he likes to have those little conversations with him. And I think he likes a combination of two things. I think he likes Bashir's naivete, but he also likes mentoring him to teach him to not be quite so naive.
And I like that he sort of, in ways, feeds that naivete, you know, by being so deceitful. And But I agree with you. He is trying to get him out of that. He is trying to broaden his horizons to realize that not everything everyone says is the absolute truth. So yes, you're absolutely right on that, Paul. This, you know, the relationship that we see emerge here with Garak and Bashir is going to be carried on later through the season is one of the great things about this character as well.
And this is, you know, for better or for worse, sometimes you got to be careful what you wish for because it's not the best thing. But I think this is what we want from Quark. We want him to be the scoundrel with the heart of gold. We don't want him to be truly dark. So, you know, showing that side of it and giving him motivations and actually having him have somebody that he clearly cares about more than money, you know, from a selfish point of view, is a positive.
Now, do you think that in reality he actually did care about Natima so much that he was willing to forgo money, to forgo getting caught by Odo for having this cloaking device, that this was all done motivated out of love? I mean, if we're taking this as, you know, an analog for Casablanca, yes, we have to think that. But knowing Quark's character, do you think there wasn't some sort of profit motivation behind it?
I think Quark always has profit motivation where he can fit it in, but I think we found the one person at this point that he would place above profit. That doesn't mean if he did form a lasting relationship with her that he wouldn't still value profit and go after it as much as he could, but I think he would do it and continue his relationship with her as well. I think eventually Quark, you know, it's almost like an alcoholic who's in love with somebody and you know, they promise they're going to give up and, you know, give up alcohol because they do love that person so much, but then they fail. I think ultimately that's what we would see with Quark, where he would be foregoing, you know, he'd be willing to give up his financial goals and be more selfless and, you know, properly motivated for her, but eventually he would fail and do something that would destroy their relationship anyway. But he would try. That's the way I see that.
Yeah,
he can't go against his own nature.
But I think he would want to. He cared enough about her that he would, you know, he would go to Prophets Anonymous. Not Prophets as in listen to the Prophets. I mean Prophets as in profit and loss. You know, he would try to fight his nature, but he would ultimately fail.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree too.
We got
anything else on this one?
No, I really enjoyed. One of the things I enjoyed was Quark's trying to convince Odo of his desire of, you know, what he wanted to do, that he wanted to try and get these people off the station, that he had to. One of the best lines for me was Quark promising that he will tell Odo everything, every underhanded, every deceitful, every malfeasance that his brother does to allow him to have these things done.
And Quark's reaction, I'm sorry, Odo's reaction, well, tempting though that offer is.
No.
I also like that Odo's reading Mickey Spillane.
Oh yeah, he was reading Eye of the Jury, yeah.
So that was quite good.
Another quote from the one, I never told you this, Odo, but I consider you as dear to me as my brother. And then Odo's response is, I've seen how well you treat him.
See, once again, Odo is not motivated by anything other than doing the right thing. He's not releasing these people because it's because it's the just thing to do. And, you know, once again, that's, you know, they're keeping in line with Odo's characterization throughout the show. He's a just lawman, and even if the Bajoran government has required these people to be taken to Cardassian for the prison transfer, he would be willing to do the thing that goes against them if it is the just thing. So there's great character. Like we say in a lot of these shows, it's the character moments that elevate this show beyond just an average episode. Well, that and the inclusion of Garrick, because obviously that increases the episode's watchability factor by a bar of gold press platinum, at least.
At least.
Oh, no question.
Warren was in this episode. I think we talked about it last episode. He has a much more prominent role, specifically because they're doing a lot of scenes in the bar, and you can't have a bar scene, really, without Warren in there. So
there is one scene where you see him actually flirting with a Dabo girl.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a mention, I can't remember what it was, last episode or this episode, about Jake meeting up with a Dabu player and or
yes.
falling in love with him. And I can't remember, I don't know if that was this episode or not, but it was it was just a little throwaway line, you know. And I know that she'll be introduced later on in the episode. I don't think it's Chase. It's not Chase Masterson, I don't think, is it?
No, I don't think so.
She's Marta.
Okay.
But I don't know if that's the same girl that they're talking about here.
But when I looked at it on Memory Alpha, they said whoever it is he's talking about in season 3, they revisited.
Okay. Well, there you go. But, yeah, and I the only real plot hole I could see about it was there, you know, and now that I think about it, this is a Cardassian station, so maybe the Federation hadn't put up the same sort of sensors that they would have on Federation starships that would notify you if there was unauthorized phaser fire going on, because that's a trope that they sort of brought into play in Star Trek VI, where you could fire a phaser on the ship without the alarms going off. So maybe they don't have that here on the station, because
it's not a Federation station.
Yeah, not only that, but they hadn't installed anything like that. So either way, this could allow people to shoot phasers off in any point in time and be able to get away with it. So
I don't think the Cardassians probably care when you fire phasers off.
Probably not.
It would stop them being able to do political assassinations.
Yeah. Well, and not that they're known for that. Okay, but do we have anything else we want to say about this?
I
think we've covered all the salient points.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and go with my, you know, my ratings. I'm gonna give this a 4. Like I said, yes, it's an episode. Yes, it's a recreation of Casablanca, but that's not a bad thing. If you're going to homage or rip off, depending upon how much money you're spending on the episode, a movie classic, Casablanca, you can't go wrong with that. The character moments were great, as we keep mentioning, like a broken record. The characters are the thing that propel this show forward. Garrick's great. Quark is great. You know, even Mary Crosby is Natima is great. You know, the fact that she, you know, did, you know, swapped spit with Armin Shimerman and those pointy teeth and looked like she was enjoying it is a credit to her. So, yeah, 4 bars of gold breast platinum for me.
I pretty much agree with you on that. I like the Casablanca theme. I like seeing Quark's personality and not finding him repulsive once in a while. And Garrick was great. So it probably would be a 3.5 star episode, except I think Garrick brings it up and it makes it a 4.
I'm going to go 4 as well for the same reasons. I honestly think it's a 3-star episode without Garrick, because it is just Casablanca. They don't bring anything new to it, whereas him being in it does. Just his very presence, the way he delivers his lines, the way he just steals the scenes from everyone around him. Watch him in the background as well when other people are acting. He never stops doing something, selling the idea that Garrick's always watching, he's always thinking, he's always planning 7 steps ahead of everyone else. He's masterful. So for me, he gets the extra star. It's a 3-star episode, but 4, simply because of Andy Robinson.
Yeah, I can't disagree with Eric. Yeah, I'm wondering if he was in the series more, if that would diminish how much we enjoy him when we see him in the episodes, because I'm kind of wondering if we had too much Garrick, if we had him as a regular cast member rather than, you know, this occasional guest star, if we'd be kind of bored with him.
I think if he was like Dr. Smith from Lost in Space,
God,
I think we'd get tired of him.
Oh, the but
he does
Yeah.
Finish what you're saying, Andy. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just going to say he does become more prevalent as the series goes on. I mean, he's in a couple more episodes now before we get to the end of season two. So it's already starting because they've realized how brilliant he is.
See, I think the character of Garrick would lose a little something because him being sparsely put in there keeps the mystery aspect of him going. And I think that's an enjoyable aspect of it. However, I think Andy Robinson is such an excellent actor and brings so much to the part that I don't think we'd ever get tired of his portrayal of the role, if that makes sense. I think the character might be diminished by putting it out there too much. But if you, as long as you gave him a character written in a way that that character can continue to be intriguing, I don't ever see his performance as lagging, and I do think that's something that would keep us wanting to come back.
I can agree with that, definitely.
Now, okay. We finished off our email bag, so I went onto iTunes, and unfortunately, the only emailer is also the only iTunes reviewer. And we've read Gene's
Hi, Gene!
Review in the past, so
I think we read his review like a couple of times.
For the two or three other people that might listen to this show, please go onto iTunes and give us a rating. I won't even say what rating to give us, although 5 stars would be nice. But that's how people find the show, and I think as much as we enjoy the show, and we are going to continue doing it through 20, 30 different series that we're doing, it'd be nice if people were, you know, people who do have a mind to listen to this type of thing would be able to find it. And that's how they find it. If you give it iTunes reviews, it makes us more prominent. And then when people do searches, they find us.
Yeah, I think also helping the show was actually labeling it a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast, because just the title, Listen to the Prophets, could have, you know, a myriad number of ideas of what people would think the show about. You know, it could be religious base, it could be actual profit, like money base. So I think labeling it a Deep Space Nine podcast does help, but iTunes reviews would definitely boost our Q rating, I guess, whatever you call it that makes us popular, our iTunes rating. So please, if you would be so kind to go out and give us a, you know, just any type of review. We'd prefer a 5-star one, but if you don't think we're doing 5 stars, well, blame me. That's because it's my problem, I guess.
Yes, I say if we're not 5 stars, it's Sean's fault. Mm-hmm. If it's not Sean's fault, it's Andy's fault.
I take full responsibility.
If it's not Andy's fault, it's the material.
It's never Paul's fault, though.
If it's not
ever
the material, it's the internet.
Thanks for stepping up, Paul. So,
I'm nothing if not a stand-up guy.
So, do we have something interesting coming up next episode, Andy?
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, Kepla, it's the Klingons.
Yay! Well, I'm looking forward to this one. You know, I don't know what I haven't watched it since probably the original time it came out, but if I'm thinking this is going to be really good, and they even got some of the characters who played the characters back. It's it's the original actors, isn't it?
Yeah, Kor's John Colicos, Kang is Michael Ansara, and Koloff is William Campbell, all returning from Errand of Mercy, Day of the Dove, and The Trouble with Tribbles, respectively.
This is going to be, you know, I'm certain we could probably bitch about, you know, why they're now Imperial looking Klingons, but who cares? They're all back, and I think it's going to be great. So I guess that ends the show. Thanks everyone for downloading, listening. Send us iTunes reviews, email us at listentotheprophets@gmail.com, and come back in a couple of weeks for our next episode, Blood Oath. We'll talk to you guys then. Bye-bye. Bye
bye. Bye.
And we're out.
Yep.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Fox is notorious for doing shows, you know, ordering seasons of shows and only airing a few of them before just completely shit canning the entire series.
Fox.
Type level.
I just like right.
Sucks.
I hate Fox.
I don't. Star Wars did.
Yeah, but the TV network has had problems.
Well, they're notorious for canceling things way too quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and see, that doesn't make sense because they're not... Until they really got American Idol, which is sad, they really weren't a top-tier network. You know, they were always lagging behind. You know, maybe you could put some of their genre shows like The X-Files or, you know, The Simpsons, you know, as sort of top-tier things, but... They never were ratings giants. They never had consistent top 20 TV shows. You know, that was all the big three over here, ABC, CBS, and NBC. So why they wouldn't allow these sort of genre shows to try and get some traction before they pulled them is just beyond me. But I'm obviously not a network programming executive, so what do I know?
But I think the fact that American Idol was the hit that it was is more of a bit poor reflection on our society than it is on Fox.
Sadly, I'd agree with that. Isn't that all over the place? Did that start in the UK with Cowell doing, you know, UK Idol or something like that?
I think, I don't know what it was called over here, but he does do something, yeah. I don't watch any of them, so I don't know.
See, I know they've
got... I used to catch, like, the last 10 minutes of the one that was on before Doctor Who. That was it.
See, I know they've got Britain's Got Talent, and we've got something like that.
You've got America's Got Talent, that's the same show. And we've got The Voice.
We've got The Voice as well.
Right, we have that, or a version of that. We have Strictly Come Dancing, which we sold to you as Dancing with the Stars.
Dancing with the Stars.
Because I Come Dancing was on in the 70s. I used to endure it waiting for Starsky and Hutch. It was an awful show then. It's quite fun now. It was boring as crap when I was 10.
Yeah, we used to have something like that. Wasn't there some show with, like, Danny Terrio?
Oh,
Where they had people... Was it Dance Fever?
That's it. That's exactly it. Dance Fever.
And it was very...
He was famed as the man who taught John Travolta how to dance.
Yeah. So there's something that you want to have on your tombstone.
But then he took over... He left the show because he obviously went on to bigger and better things and was replaced by Danny Terrio. Not Danny Terrio. Adrian Zemed. He wasn't Danny
Terrio. Oh, sweet lord. That's a huge step down, I would say.
I'm sure Fred Astaire was spinning in his grave.
But he will have been spinning elegantly.
That's true. Yeah, the reality show trend just saddens and bores me. I took the kids to see Ant-Man yesterday, and before we got there a little early, And they have these, the AMC theaters have these sort of sneak previews or these things they call first look. And I guess there is now some show that's essentially like the Real Housewives of whatever, name your own city. But it's
Real
done...
Housewives of butt New York.
Yeah, pretty much. Except this one. Is there actually a town like that? Because I've seen Yoskin.
I'm sure there's towns that could be named that.
Okay.
I was going to say, if I ever get to New York, I want to visit both.
No, you don't. I think it's called Rikers Island.
That sounds more like some place that you'd find in the South. But the thing is, they've got this show that's essentially the Real Housewives or thing, but it's done with little people. So it's
the Real
so basically,
Housewives of
Hollywood.
Yes.
The Real Housewives of Endor.
You know, and all I could think of, sadly, when I was watching the preview of it was, man, there must be a lot of ATMs with no one working in them. That one's for you, Scott Gardner. I know you won't listen, but I put that in there for you. Damn you, you're not going to listen to the show.
We'll have to get him on so that he'll listen to it.
I know.
He's kind of like the opposite of me.
he said, you know, I've IM'd him a bunch of times and said, you know, if you ever want to come on the show, you're more than welcome to. And he was like, yeah, I'd love to come on the show. And then nothing. So.
He's worth it until we get to the tribbles.
I'm pretty certain. You know,
yeah,
we can
I don't think he wants to be on here before we have Worf.
See, as much as I agree that the Worf episodes and when, you know, Worf comes on the show, it's, you know, from then on out, it's all good. But there's a lot of good stuff, you know, prior to that, so...
Hmm. Well, Angela watches this one with me, and she was saying, it's not as good until he shaves his head.
I agree. It gets a little bit more... I don't know that it gets more edgy. But it just feels tighter.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think it does get more edgy. Because I think that coincides with them all buggering off to do Voyager, doesn't it? And Ira Burr taking over full time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by season four, I think Voyager had started. Because they opened up Voyager with a scene of them in Quark's bar. It was either season four or season five. But yeah, that's when they all started doing Voyager. And yeah, I could... You know, it's not that I dislike Voyager, but I just wasn't engaged as with Voyager as I was with Deep Space Nine.
We were talking about that the other day, you know, Bill Scott and I, and I was saying, I don't find the characters in Voyager as engaging, and I think that's the reason. It's not so much the plots as it is, outside of the Doctor and Seven of Nine, to me, there's nobody who's really a standout character. We were debating Tuvok a little bit, but the ensemble cast doesn't do it for me the same way it does on DS9.
Well, no, I'm exactly the same as you. Beyond those two characters, I've got very little interest. I've tried. I've gone on the internet. You know where they do these 10 best episode things? And if you find four lists, and they've all got different episodes on. And I've watched most of them. And I find some of them, they look quite spectacular. There's a couple of the Borg two-hour movie ones that rival First Contact for how good they look. But I'm not particularly engaged with them, and I never grew to like Kate Mulgrew, and I thought Chakotay was a block of wood. So if you don't like the captain and the first officer, you're on the back foot anyway with the Star Trek show. But yeah, I like Robert Picardo, and when Jeri Ryan shows up, she's quite good as well. Although, have you read her behind the scenes gossipy stuff?
No, I haven't.
She and Kate Mulgrew hated each other. Kate
really?
Mulgrew... Yep, Kate Mulgrew treated her like shit for the first couple of years that she was on the show because she saw her as a rival to her, what's his name? She didn't do off-camera dialogue for her. She, when they do over-the-shoulder shots, she wouldn't be there for her, so she was acting to nothing or a member of the crew. And she only became nice to her when she started shagging Brannon Braga.
She wasn't a rival at all because she passed up Kate Mulgrew like she was standing still.
I mean, I respect Voyager for casting a 40-year-old woman as the lead, but I just never grew to like Catherine Janeway at all. She's never interesting.
You know, I can agree with you about the characterizations of the people on the show. I'm, you know, aside from Picardo and Jeri Ryan, you know, I didn't really have any real relationship with any of the people on the show. But I would also say that the stories weren't as engaging. They had some really bad stories. I'm trying to remember one of the worst Star Trek episodes. Comes from Voyager, I would think, and that's that one where somehow Janeway and not Harry Kim, but the pilot, Tom Paris, get beamed down to this planet and turn into like salamanders and sort of
I don't remember that.
I can't remember what the name of it is, but I just remember it being stupid as hell.
Really? Because it sounds quite well thought out.
No, it was. It was bad.
Didn't they do an episode of Next Generation where they all reverted to primates?
But all that said, just so that my my thought process is clear here, I still enjoy watching Voyager once in a while. And I don't hate the show.
If there's nothing else.
I don't hate the show. It's just it's not to me. It falls below it, of the Star Trek series. It is my least favorite. Mm. But I could still sit and watch it, and it's no problem.
Yeah, it's like bad Star Trek is even better than a lot of normal shows.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's what it comes down to. Now, an episode where they turned into salamanders, maybe I'll skip that.
Yeah, I wonder if I'm not even going to try and look it up because it's not even worth the time. It's just try and avoid it. I'm sorry you didn't go see Ant-Man. I was hoping that we'd get to discuss it because I was pretty impressed with it.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, well, we were away last weekend, which is when it opened. And when we came back on Tuesday, I had to do a bloody fantastic cast recording. And Tuesday's cheap day at the cinema. Scrubber Tuesday, Michael calls it. And so we couldn't go then, because I had to do that bloody recording. And then I'm like, I'm not paying £10 for a ticket when I can go on a Tuesday and pay £3.50. So we're waiting until Tuesday, so we'll probably go and watch it on Tuesday. So it'll be the first Marvel movie I didn't see opening weekend since... God, it's forever, I think.
See, that's why it only made $58 million its opening weekend. Because of me.
Well, and sorry
me.
About that.
And
it seems to have legs. It seems like everybody... I've only seen a couple of people saying things about it, and I've not read them, because I've not seen the film. And one of them was hipster finding offense bullshit, so I don't really care what he had to say.
Yeah, I'm certain there are some people who are like, oh, this is... building on stereotypes of Hispanics and stuff like
that. Yeah, that was like, exactly it. And I just thought, don't care.
No, it wasn't. In fact, the thing is, I knew Edgar Wright was associated with it. He was supposed to direct, and then this new guy came in and direct. I did not know that Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish wrote the thing.
Yeah. It went through a rewrite with Paul Rudd and the new director, but I think Paul Rudd said they didn't really change very much.
No, and I think that's why I really enjoyed it, because I'm a mark for most things Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish did. And I will say, if you liked Attack the Block, there's a lot of things in Attack the Block, certain characterizations, because the one thing that I got from Attack the Block is you get this perception of the kids in there of being sort of thuggish and being sort of underhanded, but in the end they are the heroes of that movie, and it's kind of translated here. And I think having Joe Cornish on there to write the Ant-Man movie makes those sort of underhanded characters and those sort of stereotypical minority characters have this kind of feel. So that's what I really liked about it. Yeah, then like I said, Edgar Wright, I haven't seen anything that he's done that I haven't been at least impressed about, and if not raving about.
Look up some Adam and Joe on YouTube if you get a chance. Adam and Joe were doing Star Wars figure pastiches long before Seth Green.
Yeah, we've talked about that, and I've got the DVDs of Spaced. I love Spaced. That's a hell of a lot of fun. So